Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Shahid Buttar, the Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defence Committee, to discuss the contents of the Defence Authorisation Bill the President had threatened to veto but now appears willing to sign into law. We will examine provisions in the bill the Pentagon and the FBI opposed, which the White House now accepts, and determine how much they pose a threat to the civil liberties of Americans exercising their constitutional rights under the First, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments. Then, with the announcement of a moratorium on the planned closure of more post offices and 250 mail processing plants that would eliminate 28,000 more jobs, we will discuss the real reasons the Postal Service is in financial difficulty, as opposed to the often stated misreporting by the mainstream press that the Internet is putting the Post Office out of business. The president of the National Association of Letter Carriers, Frederick Rolando, joins us to lay out the reasons why the same Congress now calling for a plan to save the Post Office is responsible for shackling it with a uniquely onerous pre-funded health and retirement fund that has billions in surplus. Then finally, we'll examine an alternative approach to the growing confrontation with Iran over its nuclear program. Mohammed Ayoub, the University Distinguished Professor of International Relations at Michigan State University, joins us to discuss why Iran wants a nuclear weapon and how best to deal with them once they have it. Here's an article at CNN, Can the World Live with a Near-Nuclear Iran? Joining us now is Shahid Buttar, who is the Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and the People's Campaign for the Constitution. Previously, he was Director of a national program to combat racial and religious profiling by federal authorities, an Associate Director of the American Constitution Society, and a public interest litigator in private practice. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shahid Buttar.
Thank you so much for having me on, Ian.
And today, of course, is a fairly critical day in terms of the Defense Authorization Bill that the president has threatened to veto. And some of the provisions have been, at least some of the objections to the White House have been altered sufficiently, particularly over Iran. But I take it that on the central issue that has got civil libertarians alarmed, the news is not good.
That's right. Originally, the White House had promised to veto the Defense Authorization Act, particularly because it included provisions that would authorize military detention without trial of U.S. citizens. And while the White House's concerns with respect to, for instance, ensuring that the FBI has an opportunity to interrogate people suspected of terrorism, and that, you know, that concern has been addressed by Congress, but the underlying concerns about military detention for U.S. citizens have not. And it does appear that the president may be poised to sign a bill that dramatically eviscerates the First, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments of the Constitution in one fell swoop while cutting out the Article III judiciary at the end of a relatively secret process in Congress in a really profound lack of transparency and, I dare say, an abdication of the oaths of office of everyone involved.
So let's go through these objections systematically. Now, the posse comitatus objection, the idea of using the military as police in the United States that came out of the end of the Civil War, where does that stand? Has that line been crossed?
Well, the bill is ambiguous with respect to the conditions under which U.S. citizens would be detained militarily. But the fact that it allows military detention at all would frontally assault precisely that provision. The Posse Comitatus Act has stood for over 100 years. And if you think about the very definition of freedom, one of the things you might include on it is the ability of a country not to be subject to its own military. And that's precisely what this bill would erode.
And in terms of the amendments of the Constitution that it violates, that walk us through those.
Sure. So the First Amendment protects several rights, including the right to speak, which is to say the right to maintain beliefs, and also the right to assembly, which is to say the right to protest. And particularly because we have long treated First Amendment-protected activism as terror, the bill allows potentially for activists to be detained militarily. So let's unpack that first piece. There are a whole different range of ways in which speech, nonviolent speech, has been criminalized. So, for instance, a separate act of Congress that passed years ago, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, it declares as terrorism the act of picketing the home of a life sciences executive. So if you have concerns, for instance, let's say hypothetically around genetically modified foods, Or let's pick a different site. Let's take the case of testing drugs on monkeys. And let's say you go to the home of a researcher who works at a lab, and you have a picket line, and all you do is raise your voice and carry a sign. You are, in the eyes of the federal government, a terrorist. And under this bill, you would not get a right to trial unless the president certified that you were supposed to have a civilian process. And that's obviously a real, really deep problem. And much of the reason why our country has been so successful over the last 250 years is precisely because we encourage people to speak their minds. And this bill would vastly increase the potential costs of speaking your mind. Whether you care about environmental issues, whether you care about peace and justice issues, or foreign policy issues, whether you care about the right to bear arms, whether you care about reproductive rights in any particular direction. You know, we've got cases here in not far from where I live. I'm in D.C. and in Maryland. The state police were caught infiltrating groups on both sides of the reproductive choice debate. And so, you know, whatever one thinks of that issue, presumably one can be a terrorist. And it's this collapse of the distinction between dissent and terror by our nation's national security establishment that really makes this bill so scary to the First Amendment.
So let's go to the Fifth.
So the Fifth Amendment ensures due process in particular, and one of the things, it's very closely wedded to the Sixth Amendment, which ensures the right to trial and access to counsel. And the point there is that if the government is going to intrude on your life and deny you the opportunity to do anything, or in this case, something as fundamental as your own individual liberty, there has to be a process, right? You're supposed to have a chance to confront your accusers and witnesses. You're supposed to have access to a representative who can plead your case before an impartial judge. Under this bill, all of those things would be taken. You wouldn't have access to counsel necessarily. Even if you did, you wouldn't have access to evidence or to confront your accusers, and you wouldn't have an impartial judge. These are all the problems that people have noted, particularly at the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay and the combatant status review tribunals that happened there. The particular scary part about the National Defense Authorization Act is it would take Guantanamo Bay and import it into the United States, not the facility, but the principle, the idea that people can be detained indefinitely without ever having a chance to appear before a judge and have their day in court. Those are very fundamental freedoms, and the fact that that would happen at all, that's the Fifth and Sixth Amendments, let alone to activists in particular, that's the First Amendment, is much of why civil libertarians are so concerned.
So does this mean that we've already witnessed a very militarized police appearing on the streets of the United States? Largely since 9/11, they've been given a lot of military equipment. And now you're telling us to prevent these violations of some of our most basic rights, the First, the Fifth, and the Sixth Amendment, the only defense that activists have in the United States now against being labeled terrorists and imprisoned without trial is a waiver by the president?
Under this bill, that's one way of interpreting it. Now, there's ambiguity. Some have claimed that Senator Feinstein's proviso in the bill, which says that it won't change anything about detainee policy, will help. I don't really, quite frankly, see that, particularly because what we're talking about here is not detainee policy, but rather criminal justice. And second, you know, courts are very shallow arbiters and protections of our rights these days. I mean, the federal courts were created to check and balance executive power, but if you look at their operation over the last generation in particular, courts have become enablers of executive power to a much greater extent than they've checked or balanced it in more or less any context. You could say that across the criminal justice arena. You could say that across, I think in particular, the phenomenon of courts deferring to state secrets essentially means that were you to potentially be accused, let's say you tried to challenge a detention in court, you know, courts don't scrutinize claims of secrecy by the executive branch. It's just not what they tend to do. We live in an era where courts are very deferential rather than independent. And so there is the theoretical chance that a well-intentioned judge who cares about the Constitution somewhere in the country might intervene if you happen to be in the right court. But I think that's a pretty thin thread on which to hang the entire edifice of our liberty and freedom.
Well, I recall, though, during the Bush-Cheney revelations about torture, before they were revealed, in fact, that the Supreme Court did strike them down in terms of military tribunals, didn't they?
In the Guantanamo cases, yeah, the detainee cases are the one area under the Bush administration when the Article III judiciary did exercise a check. And we can distinguish that in the first instance from all the surveillance cases where, you know, the courts insulated, for instance, the NSA's warrantless wiretapping scheme that tracks your emails and your phone calls. That's been insulated by courts from ever even appearing before the public. No one even knows the full scope of the program because it remains secret. And in the cases that have challenged it, they've been, you know, thrown out of court, again, around this deference to state secrets. Currently, there's a case in Southern California, in fact, challenging the FBI's infiltration of a series of faith institutions. And in that case, too, the Obama Justice Department, the Holder Justice Department, I should say, under the Obama administration, has claimed that just even hearing the case would expose state secrets, and so it can't be heard. And that's the current claim before the court. In the detention cases, there were a series of court decisions that attempted to reiterate the right to trial. It's interesting to note what ultimately happened, though. In every single case, Congress overruled the court, and in the most recent round of litigation, the court, and I think it was 2008, was the Boumediene decision, which ensured, again, for essentially the third time, that detainees at Guantanamo Bay enjoy a right to habeas corpus, and then you look at the subsequent jurisprudence in the D.C. Circuit, and it's like that case never happened. And in fact, there are currently dozens of detainees at Guantanamo Bay whom the Army and the executive branch have cleared for release, but they can't be moved anywhere, A, because the D.C. Circuit stands in the way, and B, because Congress tied the president's hands with respect to detainee resettlement. So while courts do occasionally check executive abuses, and one would hope, in the context of indefinite detention without trial, as the court has defended the rights of detainees, that the court might vindicate the rights of particular U.S. citizens who would be detained. But just to be, you know, look at the facts on the ground, to get to the Supreme Court is at least a 3-year process. So unless we're comfortable with U.S. citizens, and potentially activists in particular, being locked up without any right to review for 3 years on the basis of their speech, there's still plenty of reasons to be concerned about the National Defense Authorization Act.
And Shahid Bhattar, you don't see any quick challenge then from the Supreme Court if, given the severe nature of these foundations of our liberties, First, Fifth, and Sixth, being diluted in such a way to change the very nature of our liberties?
You're right, absolutely, that the bill is poses a very fundamental change to our liberties. And there are two tracks on which court challenges happen. They can be as applied in a particular instance, and that's the scenario we just talked through in which, you know, maybe someone, let's say the bill passes and 6 months from now someone gets detained militarily, and then they file a case and it goes up on appeal and then before the Supreme Court, and that will take several years. There's an alternative track, facial challenges to bills for just being unconstitutional on their face. And it is precisely that scenario that I think the court would be very poorly poised to defend the Constitution, particularly because the last time the Supreme Court wrote a seminal opinion, you know, one that has attained controlling force over time in the arena of executive power, really dates back to the Korean War, when President Truman attempted to nationalize the steel mills. And in the Youngstown Sheet and Steel case, the concurring opinion by Justice, I believe it was Jackson, has been held essentially as the governing framework. And Justice Jackson's opinion constructs a scenario, or a framework, let's say, in which the court is to assess assertions of executive power, like, for instance, the right to detain people without trial, in the context of Congress's act. And where Congress has attempted to deny that power to the president or has merely remained silent after considering it, that's a strike against it, so to speak, and that's supposed to be a basis for the court to intervene. And that's what the court did in the Youngstown Sheet and Steel case, because the Congress had never authorized the president to nationalize the steel mills in Youngstown, Ohio. But however, here, in this case, Congress is authorizing the president to militarily detain people. And so under the Steel Caesars case and that framework, the court today wouldn't have a hook. Under that framework, this act, however unconstitutional and however offensive to fundamental liberties, the court wouldn't have a basis to rule against it. Now, having said all that, while courts are theoretically on the basis of applying neutral principles consistently over time, you know, that's what distinguishes law from politics, our contemporary Supreme Court under Chief Justice Roberts seems to be quite inclined to throw precedent to the wind in its effort to reshape society. And so it may well be the case that the court would be inclined to hear a challenge, but this is, you know, this is sort of the equivalent of jurisprudential dice rolling.
And you've just told us, Shahid Bhatta, that if a U.S. citizen, say a protester with the Occupy movement, for example, was detained by the military, that may become a test case, but it'll take a while, 2 or 3 years. Under the new rules that the president apparently agreed to, and he's apparently not going to veto this bill, there's some sort of waiver that he's been given to take the curse off it, if you will. But first of all, under military detention, I wasn't sure that the habeas corpus applies. Would you know that somebody's disappeared?
Not necessarily, right? I mean, that's just it. You don't. None of the criminal justice's systems protections apply in military detention, so you wouldn't know your rights necessarily. No one would ever tell them to you.
But your family wouldn't know, or your girlfriend wouldn't know you disappeared.
Not that this is essentially a bill that authorizes disappearances. I mean, it could well be the case that the executive branch would construct some program to notify, for instance, friends and family. But one of the key pieces about this issue that's important to note is that it's not the current president who, he will certainly have the ability to use this law too, but it's every future president too. And the nature of the military is that they can just change the process at whim, right? So, A, no one knows what the current practice would be. B, nothing would keep it from changing arbitrarily. And C, this is particularly what I'd invite your listeners to think about. Do you want a President Gingrich holding the power to detain people arbitrarily without trial? Or would you want a President Palin with that power, or, you know, pick someone on the other side of the aisle? But the point here is that executive power, again, to use the words of Justice Jackson, is like a loaded gun lying around waiting for some president to grab it. And it's what the world will look like after this bill passes is very hard to say, both because the bill is ambiguous and because, quite frankly, the military doesn't even know what to do with it. The Secretary of Defense opposed this bill throughout, and I think one of the reasons is that the military doesn't know how to detain U.S. citizens. It's not something they've ever had to, I mean, they have done it before, don't forget. It wasn't only 60 years ago, I suppose, that the Japanese internment locked up 100,000 Americans without any suspicion of wrongdoing. So we're basically stepping back into that era. It's not an ethnic roundup, but it is a roundup authority, and it's an authority that any future president could abuse. And the danger of these powers being potentially politicized is precisely why, historically, our nation has very consistently and assertively rejected these powers and kept them from emerging. And I think it's particularly galling and ridiculous, quite frankly, were it not so serious, that this is happening now in 2011. You know, Osama bin Laden was just killed earlier this year. Al-Qaeda is a shadow of its former self. It's been decimated. Why exactly are we shredding the First, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments, along with the Posse Comitatus Act, and cutting out the Article III judiciary over a ragtag band of somewhere between 50 and 100 people in the mountains of Afghanistan, who the CIA trained 30 years ago? I mean, it's really ridiculous when you take a look at what has happened, you know, stepping back from the particular bill to think about this in the sort of context of our nation's history. Were it not so serious, it would be it would be a really funny joke.
Well, just in closing, though, Shahid, it's a little hard to understand why you've got Panetta representing the Department of Defense against it. You've got General Krulak, former head of the Marine Corps, and General Hoare, both writing very, very passionate rejections of this bill, saying that the American military should never be doing this kind of policing, let alone violating the rights of their own citizens that they're sworn to protect and defend. You had the FBI director weighing in. They didn't carry the day. So who the hell's pushing this thing? Who is behind this rush to shred our Constitution?
It is interesting here in D.C. A lot of us advocates are wondering the same question. I mean, it does seem to be a lot of smoke and mirrors. I will tell you that on the day of the Defense Authorization Act vote in the Senate last week, the speaker at the Republican luncheon was the former Vice President Dick Cheney. And there are certainly reports that he's been all over the Hill in the last several months. You know, when I would say that were the law equally applied, the man would have been in jail for the last several years. But he's not, and he's been free to promote his agenda. And it does seem that the neoconservative cabal that ran the White House under the Bush administration is today pulling strings in Congress and motivating laws that very much extend that paradigm. I mean, it's worth noting, we never saw anything even remotely as bad under the Bush administration. I mean, the Patriot Act was horrible. The FISA Amendments Act were horrible. The Military Commissions Act, all that stuff was bad, but nothing is as bad as the Defense Authorization Act in 2011. This compounds those abuses dramatically. And it is bizarre, quite frankly, that this is happening now. Having said all that, I do want to leave your listeners with one note of hope. Tomorrow happens to be the anniversary of the ratification of the Bill of Rights. And there are dozens of grassroots actions planned around the country, including in Los Angeles. And there are opportunities for anybody to raise your voice. And I think this demonstration of the failure of Congress, this demonstration of the failure of the White House, this demonstration of the failure of our political process really, I think, compels Americans of conscience from whatever political persuasion you might have, you know, be you a right-wing, believer in whatever principles you might hold dear, or a left-wing adherent to whatever visions of equality. If you have a vision, or if you just believe anything that would at some point prompt you to raise your voice, this bill is very much a matter of your individual self-interest. And it's certainly a matter of the self-interest of our polity collectively, because if we close the space for dissent, if we remove due process, if we deny Americans the freedoms that have long made our country great, I think we not only do the terrorists work for them by undoing our society, but we also doom our next generation to a very dark potential future, and one certainly far darker than we who are alive today have had a chance to embrace.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Shahid Bhatar.
Thank you so much. If I may just tell your listeners where they can go to find more information, online at BORDC, that's Bill of Rights Defense Committee, BORDC.org/NDAA. You can click an interactive map and find an action near you, and I'd certainly encourage anyone who cares about the Bill of Rights or the Constitution to raise your voice tomorrow.
Again, I thank you for joining us. Again, I've been speaking with Shahid Bhatar, who is the Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and the People's Campaign for the Constitution. Previously, he was Director of the National Program to Combat Racial and Religious Profiling by Federal Authorities, an Associate Director of the American Constitution Society, and a public interest litigator in private practice. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the real reason why the post office is in financial trouble.
Jealous, words try to control. Bear what we say. Try to stop what we do.
He's gonna do it by hand. He's gonna do it. 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 He's gonna do it by hand.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Frederick Orlando, the president of the National Association of Letter Carriers. He began his career in 1978 and quickly became involved in the union upon experiencing the antagonistic way management treated letter carriers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frederick Orlando.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And the U.S. Postal Service has agreed to a moratorium on the closing of more post offices and mail facilities until May the 15th of next year, apparently to allow Congress time to work on a plan to save the service. My understanding is that Congress, in many ways, is responsible for why the service is in such terrible shape.
Yes, that's partially accurate. Yes, that's true.
Well, tell me what it is that Congress has done to hamstring the service.
Well, this dates back to 2006 when Congress passed the Postal Enhancement and Accountability Act. And part of that bill required the Postal Service to pre-fund their future retiree health benefits for the next 75 years and do so in a period of 10 years. That's something that no other federal agency and no other corporation is required to do, with an intent likely that the intent of that was that out of the profits that the Postal Service had, they would be able to pre-fund future retiree health benefits. The problem was that the provision had no language as to what to do if you didn't have sufficient profits to do that, because the cost of doing that in a 10-year period was approximately $5.5 billion a year. That's interesting to note that during the 4 years from 2006 to 2010, those fiscal years, despite the fact that we were in the worst recession in 80 years and despite the fact that we lost volume to the Internet and so forth, the Postal Service still turned a profit of some $600 million. And while that's pretty good because they did a lot of internal cost-cutting and so forth, working with the unions and the employees and so forth, it certainly wasn't enough of a profit to pay off this $5.5 billion. So in effect, all the losses that we read about in the headlines and so forth during that period really had nothing to do with the Postal Service's core business of delivering the mail. What it had to do with was depleting their savings and their borrowing authority to pay this $21 billion for pre-funding future retiree health benefits.
So who came up with this plan that you say is unique in both government and in private business in terms of the onerous nature of it? And I understand that the Postal Service is now facing a deadline on to make a $5.5 billion payment. Who came up with this legislation?
Well, this was something that the Congress came up with. It came up through the Senate, through the subcommittee that has oversight over the Postal Service. Part of the purpose of the bill was to offset some surplus money that the Postal Service had in one of their pension funds to satisfy the scoring provisions of the Congress. And that's why these payments were required. Which is really ironic because the Postal Service, two independent actuaries, have now determined that they again have a surplus in their civil service retirement system of somewhere between $50 and $75 billion, depending on which accounting procedure is used to calculate it, which could easily be used to do the pre-funding that was required by the 2006 law.
Well, what I'm trying to find out here, Frederick Orlando, again, the president of the National Association of Letter Carriers, is whether this was some kind of ideologically driven trap that the Postal Service was placed in, since nobody else is subject to this these onerous conditions. And in terms of the public's understanding of what's happening with the post office, most of them have accepted the notion that it's to do with competition from the Internet, etc., and very little publicity has been given to this fundamental problem that you're talking about, which is unique to the post office and has been imposed upon them by the Congress. My question is, what's the motive, do you think?
Well, regardless of the intent, I mean, there's those that believe it was something that was done intentionally with a plan to privatize the Postal Service and, you know, turn it over for corporate profit rather than to serve the American people with the universal service that they're entitled to. But, you know, regardless of what the intent was, and I'm not advocating that that's what the intent was, the point is that now it needs to be fixed because there's a couple of things that need to happen for the Postal Service. Again, if this pre-funding was to either be satisfied by transferring the surplus in the pension accounts that have been overpaid by the Postal Service, or just stop the pre-funding until such a time as the Postal Service is profitable, that would satisfy part of the problem as far as the cash flow and restore the Postal Service's savings and borrowing authority and so forth. But the other thing that has to be done is as much volume that was lost during the recession and as a result of diversion to the Internet, there's a certain amount of revenue that the Postal Service does need to replace. And that's the other thing that has to be done besides fixing the pre-funding issue in Congress, is the Postal Service now has to concentrate on a business model to utilize the valuable networks that they have to find ways to replace the lost revenue, which is one of the good things about this moratorium, which is basically a moratorium on the Postal Service slashing service and destroying their networks, whether it's consolidations, closing post offices, eliminating Saturday deliveries, all the things that they've proposed that would destroy their networks. These networks are vital to the Postal Service as far as finding ways to grow the business. For example, while the Internet has certainly posed certain challenges to the volume, it also creates opportunities because more people are now shopping online and somebody's got to deliver those packages. And most people are home on Saturdays, and that's when the packages would need to be delivered. So that's just an example of some of the things that the Postal Service can do to grow the business. And again, it's very important not to destroy the networks that are so valuable to what the Postal Service does.
Again, I'm speaking with Frederick Rolando, the president of the National Association of Letter Carriers. And in announcing the moratorium, Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, and of course this moratorium would prevent or at least slow down the first-class plans to slow down first-class mail and to close 250 mail processing plants and eliminate 28,000 jobs. Dick Durbin's saying it's time for the Congress to put up or shut up. What does he mean?
Well, I think what he's referring to is there's presently about 14 different bills affecting the Postal Service in the House of Representatives or the Senate. And I think what he's referring to is for the Congress to fix what they did in 2006, because it really comes down to some policy decisions. If you're going to require the Postal Service to do something that no other agency or company has to do, which is pre-fund, if that policy decision is made, they need to also make a policy decision on the accounting methods for the pensions so that they have the surpluses for the Postal Service to pay for that. And that's the subject of the majority of the bills that are before Congress right now. So they need to act on that. And they also need to act on other provisions in the bills that would allow the Postal Service the freedom and the ability to grow their business. So I believe that's what he's referring to is to, you know, let's put the moratorium on the slashing of the networks and the slashing of the services and concentrate on what we can do to treat the Postal Service fairly and to allow them to grow their business. And keep in mind, all the funds that we're talking about, whether it's the pre-funding or the surpluses in the civil service or the FERS account, we're not talking about tax dollars at all. We're talking about the Postal Service hasn't received any tax dollars in almost 30 years. So we're talking about money that has been received from the sale of services within the Postal Service.
So this has nothing to do with the arguments over the deficit and the budgets?
No tax money involved whatsoever.
Right. So what then is going on? Why does Representative Darrell Issa, the California Republican, who is head of the Oversight Committee, he's saying that the service has caved into political pressure. What do you think he's talking about?
I'm confused by Darrell Issa a little bit. I understand some of his agenda. I mean, I understand that he's anti-administration and that he's anti-government and that he's anti-middle class and so forth. And I get all that and understand what drives him there. But what I don't get is, you know, the Postal Service is the cornerstone of a much bigger industry that supports the Postal Service, whether it be printing, you know, and all the businesses that go along with that. We're talking about like $1.3 trillion postal industry that employs between 7.5 and 8 million workers. So I'm confused by the attacks that he is directly making on small businesses all over the country with this agenda, whatever is driving it. So very confusing.
So the Postmaster General, Patrick Donahue, he apparently has, you know, really come out against all of these bills, basically saying, I don't know how many of the bills there are, you mentioned there's a whole bunch of them, saying that they don't go far enough. So what is there a bill there that will get the post office out of the debt spiral?
Well, you know, there's a couple of bills that make a pretty good start. For example, H.R. 1351 in the House is a bill that acknowledges the surplus that was made in the civil service retirement system and provides for the return of that $50 to $75 billion to the Postal Service to use for the to satisfy the pre-funding mandate from 2006. There's some bills that are very damaging. There's bills that would eliminate six-day delivery. It's important that there's a balance here. You've got to control your costs. You've got to look for ways to become more efficient, but not at the expense of jeopardizing the value of the networks that are the Postal Service and that would make it possible to grow the business and to adapt to the society and replace the revenues and so forth.
Well, just in closing, Frederick Rolando, again, the president of the National Association of Letter Carriers, you began your career in 1978, and you became involved with the union after experiencing the antagonistic way management treated letter carriers. I think the public's familiar with the term that's used of going postal. What happened to the post office? Why did the working conditions put so much pressure on letter carriers? What did that come out of? Was that another effort to make it more efficient or competitive with private enterprise? What was the motive behind creating working conditions that you witnessed that made life so difficult for the workers?
It's a culture. This is a very large company, and making changes is not easy in a company this size. And there's a certain culture that needs to be changed in the management styles. It's something we've been working on for years. I know in my 30 years we've worked on it. And there's people on both sides that are interested in changing that culture. And we don't really need anybody's help with that. That's something we'll work through internally. And we've made great strides over the years. As far as the term going postal, I mean, that's something that's so blown out of proportion. There's, been events over the years that have happened. But if you look at the size of this company, and the number of events that have happened, it's minuscule compared to industries, other industries, and business in general around the country. It's a shame that we have that type label.
But you apparently did experience what you consider to be a hostile work way management was treating letter carriers, and that led you to join the union and eventually become the leader, the head of the union.
Sure, and like I said, that's an internal issue at the Postal Service that both sides will continue to work on. And in a company of this size, it's going to take years to do so. And hopefully we'll continue to have people on both sides that want to work towards that.
So
it's a lot easier to do in a small company, but in a company of this size, it takes a long time.
So you're happy with the Postmaster General then, Patrick Donahoe, and his advocacy on your behalf, on behalf of your members?
Yeah, I believe that we're on the same page with regard to a lot of the things that the Congress does. Where we differ is we advocate finding ways to use the networks to grow the business, whereas he's been advocating the slashing of services and so forth, and we think that it's vital that we maintain those networks and those services so that we can grow the business.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Frederick Rolando.
Okay, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Frederick Rolando, who is the president of the National Association of Letter Carriers. He began his career in 1978 and quickly became involved in the union upon experiencing the antagonistic way management treated letter carriers. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about whether we can live with a nuclear-armed Iran.
What's my station? Oh, just tell me what I should do. I don't need to be kind to the armies of night that would do such injustice to you. Or bow down and be grateful and say, should take all that you see to the men who move on me in dimly lit halls and determine my future for me.
I wanna walk through the empty streets with something constant under my feet. But all the news reports recommended I stay indoors.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mohammed Ayoub, who is a University Distinguished Professor of International Relations at Michigan State University, where he holds a joint appointment in the James Madison College and the Department of Political Science. He's a specialist on conflict and security in the Third World, and he's the author of The Many Faces of Political Islam, Religion and Politics in the Muslim World. He has an article at CNN, Can the World Live with a Near-Nuclear Iran? Welcome to Background Briefing, Mohammed Ayoub.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
And yesterday I spoke with Steve Walt at Harvard, and he mentioned he had a kind of wish list for the great diplomatic breakthroughs that could be made but probably won't be made in the context of like Nixon's visit to China. And one of them was the idea that the United States would wake up one day and be suddenly enlightened and decide to take the military option off the table vis-a-vis Iran. And I'm exploring that notion further with you because I think from your article at CNN, I got the impression that in many ways that you were on the same page as Stephen Walt in the sense that continuing to threaten this country with a paranoid government that's looking over its shoulder at its own vastly discontented people, by threatening them constantly, you basically force everybody to rally around the flag, and you can't peel off the people that you want to break away from the government, the people that prosecuted the Green Revolution. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's true in large measure. I think the military option, if exercised, would really be counterproductive because, as I've argued in the article, it may set the Iranian program back by a few years, but it would only energize them to do it much more quickly and much more efficiently. And now, once the attacks have taken place, and even in the glare of publicity, because they wouldn't care about being secretive about it, and they would have a lot of international sympathy as well, and they'd walk out of the NPT. But I don't think that an Israeli or an American or a combined attack would really be able to terminate the program. I mean, they've done things like underground bunkers and all sorts of things. I mean, I'm not a technical person, but from what I've been reading, that lead me to believe that wouldn't be possible. I also think that, as I've argued in this article, that the decision to make nuclear weapons or develop nuclear weapons capability is in large measure the function of the strategic environment of a particular country. And as I've said in this article, the Iranian political elite, and across the board, I think, it's not merely the current ruling elite, but also those waiting in the wings or the opposition, they are of more or less of one mind on this, that they live in a very threatening strategic environment. And the reason is simple. They look to the West and they see a nuclear-armed Israel, which is hostile to Iran. They look to the north and they see Russia, which is nuclear-armed, but also they realize that relations with Russia, while they may be okay currently, historically have been very tense. They look to the east and they see a nuclear-armed Pakistan. And they perceive Pakistan to be, despite the fact that many Pakistanis would like to disagree with it, but they perceive Pakistan as a pawn of the United States. And then, of course, above all, they look south and they see this huge, this massive military buildup, both onshore and offshore in the Persian Gulf that the United States has and with whom relations have been hostile for the last 30 years or so. And so they feel very much encircled and consequently paranoid. And one of the ways they find that they can get out of this conundrum is to have at least rudimentary nuclear weapons capability. Because, as again I've argued in this article, over the last few years, they've noticed the differential treatment meted out by the United States and its allies to a nuclear-armed North Korea and Iraq, which did not have nuclear weapons. So they feel that even a rudimentary nuclear capacity could act as a deterrent, because it would create enough uncertainty in the minds of policymakers in Washington and in other European capitals, so that they would desist from attacking Iran, either to overthrow the regime or to bring their nuclear weapons program to an end.
Again, I'm speaking with Mohammed Ayoub, who is the University Distinguished Professor of International Relations at Michigan State University, where he holds a joint appointment in the James Madison College and the Department of Political Science. And he has an article at CNN, Can the World Live with a Near-Nuclear Iran? There's probably another explanation then for the obsession, if you will, on the part of the West. Israel has often threatened to strike or ruminated about striking the nuclear facilities. The Saudis in the WikiLeaks documents have called for somebody to cut off the head of the snake. It's odd to have the Saudis and the Israelis on the same page. But one of the arguments that is made is that a nuclear-armed Iran will therefore lead to a nuclear-armed Turkey and Saudi Arabia. If Saudi Arabia doesn't develop its own, it would perhaps buy a nuclear weapon from Pakistan. Does that concern you?
Not really. No, I think that argument is flawed. I mean, if the Arab states of the Middle East had really wanted to build up, to build nuclear arsenal or arsenals, the fact that Israel possesses nuclear weapons, and this goes back to the late 60s and the early 70s, would have energized them to move in that direction, but they have not. For a number of reasons, their technological capacity, their relationship with the United States, and also I don't think, there's a whole lot of other factors at work, which I don't think would necessarily, if Iran goes nuclear, would necessarily motivate them to go nuclear. I know that they make this argument, but you have to have a certain industrial and technological infrastructure in order to be able to engage in a serious nuclear weapons program, which I don't think any of these do. I mean, Saudi Arabia has a lot of money, obviously, but it doesn't have that sort of industrial capacity. And I think they make this argument merely to convey to the United States that the Americans should do something about Iran for other reasons.
Well, you have mentioned in your article, Mohammed Ayoub, at CNN, that Ehud Barak, the former prime minister of Israel, now defense minister, responded very candidly in an interview with Charlie Rose that, in fact, if he was in Iran's shoes, he can understand why the Iranians would want a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, that's a remarkable statement. And as I said, it was in a very candid moment, one probably that he regretted after giving the interview because there was a lot of criticism heaped on him from in Israel and in the United States for having said what he did. But I think he was right. I mean, if you put yourself in the shoes of the Iranian political elite or the Iranian regime, and this is regardless of the nature of the regime, you would come to that conclusion. So, I mean, that's what has led me to conclude that they have undertaken a serious nuclear weapons program. Because if you put yourself in their shoes, it makes it logical or rational for them to do so.
So, given the current environment where you feel like this is a Cold War that doesn't have the kind of controls and mutually assured destruction discipline, if you will, that the U.S. and Soviet Cold War had. Of course, only one side has the nuclear weapons in this situation, and Iran is hardly in any way comparable to the Soviet Union. However, there's a feeling that we could drift into a clash, as much as everybody recognizes that it would be a complete catastrophe to have a war with Iran. They've tried to restrain the Israelis on the basis of that it would drive up the price of oil and tank the global economy. But nevertheless, it seems that as the pressure builds, you've got the Defense Authorization Act. Apparently, they've watered down some of the provisions to put the screws to Iran's central bank, giving the president some kind of waiver if it affects the price of oil. You've got the U.S. pulling out of Iraq, the possibility of Iranian-backed militias going after a consulate or the Green Zone. You know, we've seen the irrational behavior vis-a-vis the British Embassy. So do you feel that we're on a kind of dangerous glide path here?
Well, I hope we are not, and we don't go down that road, and that the Cold War, as you mentioned, I hope it doesn't turn hot. But you are very right that this is an asymmetrical situation. It's not like the United States-Soviet Union standoff, where both had the capacity to hit each other's homeland with nuclear weapons. And, you know, with nuclear warheads in their hundreds and thousands, really. This is not that sort of a situation. The Iranian attempt to build a nuclear weapons capability, I believe, is primarily motivated by the notion of deterrence, so that they are able to deter an attack on the Iranian homeland, whether it is to overthrow the regime or for whatever other reason, by building up a capacity that would introduce enough uncertainty so that the attack doesn't take place. As far as Afghanistan and Iraq, you mentioned, that's very germane to this entire equation. Just as you said, and we all know that the American forces from Iraq are going to move out by the end of this year, and there's going to be a winding down of American and allied presence in Afghanistan over the next couple of years. Now, Iran has major interests. It lies between Iraq and Afghanistan geographically. It has major interests. It also has a great deal of influence with certain important actors in both these countries. And I think it would have been politic on the part of Washington to see that its relationship with Iran does not deteriorate to such a point that after its withdrawal or in the process of American withdrawal, that Iran is able to inflict damage on American interests in the region. So I think there should be a recalculation of American interests vis-a-vis Iranian objectives. And the Iranians, to be, in 2002 or 2001, 2002, if you go back that far, they were willing to play ball on Afghanistan when the United States overthrew the Taliban, because actually the United States did them a favor by getting rid of one of their major irritants as far as Tehran was concerned in the region. And then in 2003, they overthrew Saddam, who was the major antagonist of Iran. And in 2001, 2002, the Iranians were willing to play ball, as I said, and were quite cooperative at the Bonn conference, at which Hamid Karzai was anointed as president of Afghanistan. This is what the United States wanted, but he was anointed with, in a way, the blessings or consent of Iran. It was unfortunate that soon after that, President George W. Bush made the State of the Union speech in which he categorized Iran as a member of the axis of evil with Iraq and North Korea, and that really turned around the relationship, the evolving relationship between Iran and the United States. I think the United States should have taken advantage of that cooperation that the Iranian regime had extended over Afghanistan to emphasize the convergence of interests, and indeed the United States and Iran do have a lot of convergence, a number of areas in which their interests converge, in Iraq or in Afghanistan, rather than those areas where their interests diverged radically.
Well, I think it was worse than that, Mohammed Ayoub. Didn't the United States essentially cut off the Iranian liberals or moderates at the knees by not engaging them, and that led to the end of Khatami and that possibility with him as the prime minister? And I recall that shortly after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the Iranians were quite concerned that they'd be next, after all the neocons had said that. And they sent a delegation through the Swiss to the White House, or at least they reached out to the White House, and Dick Cheney cut them off and basically said, we don't talk to evil.
No, that's true. The American policy, the axis of evil speech, and the policy in the immediate wake of that speech did contribute to the discrediting of the Khatami government. I don't think it was the only reason why the liberals or the progressives or the reformers in Iran lost the next election. There were a lot of domestic reasons involved as well, but it is true that the United States contributed to it, or American policy contributed to it. But my take now is that regardless of the nature of the regime, I mean, regimes come and go, but state interests remain more or less permanent. And Iran has the aspiration to be it has the wherewithal to be the preeminent actor in the Persian Gulf, the preeminent state in the Persian Gulf, and has the aspiration to be recognized as such, as if not, a predominant, at least some sort of a managerial power in that region. I mean, Iran and India have had similar aspirations. I think finally the Indo-American relationship were put on an even keel when the United States signaled to New Delhi that it was willing to accept India's role as the preeminent power in the region. And I think that sort of approach towards Iran would probably bring a positive responses from Tehran as well.
Well, it seems that the United States has finally listened to the Indian government, at least on Burma, Myanmar. And there's been a recent engagement, and India's been suggesting for some time that they should engage. India has very close relations with Iran. The U.S. and the Saudis have been leaning on India to cut off its buying oil from Iran.
Natural gas.
And I believe the Indians have refused. Is that right?
Right. Because the Indians are dependent on the import of energy from Iran. And, you know, they wouldn't want to totally lose that relationship because it's very important for economic reasons.
Yeah, but the Saudis offered to replace the supplies. That's my understanding.
Yeah, but the natural gas is, I don't think the Saudis would be able to replace the natural gas supply.
I see.
They may be able to replace the oil supplies. But obviously, I mean, Indian-Iranian relations go back a long way, too.
Right.
And I don't think the Indians would necessarily dump the Iranians in favor of Saudi Arabia just because the Saudis make some promises. Because there are other complications. The Saudis are very much involved in Pakistan, which New Delhi perceives to be the spoiler in the South Asia region. So the Saudis are seen as one of the primary backers of Pakistan. So there's a whole lot of other variables involved. Iran, although its relationship with Pakistan are on the surface quite good, the Iranians realize that in the long term, their relations, their interests and those of Pakistan diverge. And in fact, their interests and those of India converge, as they did vis-a-vis Afghanistan, for example. I mean, India and Iran were the two principal backers of the Northern Alliance. And Iran actually acted as a conduit for the flow of American aid to the Northern Alliance at the critical moment when the Northern Alliance became the spearhead for the attack on Kabul after 9/11, the terrorist attacks on 9/11.
Well, that may resume, right, the Indian-Iranian pact when the U.S. pulls out and Pakistan, through the Pashtuns and the Taliban, tried to take over the whole country of Afghanistan.
Yeah. So India and Iran have converging interests in Afghanistan as well.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're most welcome.
Mohammed Ayoub, been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Mohammed Ayoub, who is a University Distinguished Professor of International Relations at Michigan State University, where he holds a joint appointment in the James Madison College and the Department of Political Science. His latest book is The Many Faces of Political Islam, Religion, and Politics in the Muslim World, and he has an article at CNN, Can the World Live with a Near-Nuclear Iran? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.